Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Turns out there's a good reason some Republicans have no appetite for investigating the January insurrection. They're too busy hobnobbing with one of the participants. I'm John Berman, in for Anderson. And this, uncovered by CNN's K-File, is Anthony Aguero, seen here with Congresswoman Lauren Boebert on a trip Republican members took to the border on Tuesday and Wednesday when their colleagues were voting on a select committee to investigate January 6th. Aguero, a right-wing YouTube personality and close ally of Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, was there for the attack on the Capitol. But unlike a number of Republican lawmakers who have tried to blame it on Antifa, Black Lives Matter, FBI agitators, or anyone but Trump supporters, this guy makes no bones about who was responsible.
We were all there. It was not Antifa and it was not BLM. It was Trump supporters that did that yesterday. I'm the first to admit it. Being one myself.
So that was Anthony Aguero, January 7th, a day after the insurrection. And here's part of his live stream on the border 3 nights ago, during which he interviewed and chatted with House members Tom Tiffany, Lauren Boebert, you see her there, Madison Cawthorn, Chris Jacobs, Michael Cloud, John Rose, Ronnie Jackson, and Mary Miller. The members were there the night before the former president's visit, which they took part in. And as it turns out, so did this guy Aguero. Here he is. Posting on Instagram, his comment reads, "Can y'all spot me? LOL. LOL." A K-File search of court records found the guy has a history of criminal violence, including felony vehicular assault, for which he received a 2-year prison sentence. That's who these lawmakers were rubbing elbows and chatting with on Tuesday. And yes, given the moment, that's more than a bit surreal. But it's also not surprising. Even though, let's be blunt here, it damn well ought to be, all things considered. Think about it. For the first Independence Day holiday since the Civil War, this country, 245 years old on Sunday, is living in the shadow of an internal attack on democracy. It could be on the verge of another, according to a warning this week from the Department of Homeland Security. Yet one of the two political parties is doing all it can to get us all to look the other way. Some, as you saw, are even palling around with the guy at the insurrection. And this is all being tolerated by the man in charge, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, who seems to have forgotten scenes like this from another newly released batch of video.
Let go of the door and leave the Capitol. Back up. No, stop. Stop. Stop.
As that was happening, you will recall McCarthy was barricaded inside his office on the phone begging the former president to call off the mob that was breaking his windows and trying to get in. "Well, Kevin," the former president is reported to have replied, "I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." Yes, that Kevin McCarthy. This one, too.
"The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters. He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump."
That brief outburst of honesty did not last long. McCarthy soon folded like a card table, flying down to Mar-a-Lago and kissing the former president's ring, or its Latin equivalent. He showed his fealty by opposing a bipartisan commission to investigate the attack. Then he attempted to block a select committee. When that failed, he followed up by threatening the career of any Republican volunteering for it. Now he's dragging his feet on naming the members he is entitled to choose in consultation with House Speaker Pelosi. But even as he does, each day seems to bring a new reminder of just what he's trying hard to sweep under the rug. Today we learned of yet another arrest. David Marshall, another so-called oath keeper. He's the one labeled by name or with a red arrow, wearing paramilitary gear, sometimes marching in a military stack formation, according to charging documents. He was part of the group that was stockpiling guns at a nearby hotel, which they referred to as the QRF, or Quick Reaction Force Hotel. an armed second wave to what was already the worst attack on democracy since the Civil War. It's hard to even imagine, yet so easy it seems for some to try to make us forget. Perspective now from CNN senior political analyst David Gergen, also former Republican Congressman Denver Riegelman. So, David, these House Republicans, over the course of a couple days, they were palling around with this guy who was at the insurrection. They were skipping the January 6th vote, and they were all there to show their undying support for the former president and his stunt. What do you call that?
Where are you directing at, John?
David.
Hey, okay. Listen, John, I think what we're seeing is the Aguero story just underscores how vital it is that we have a national commission to investigate what happened on January 6th, and we clear the air on it. As, you know, for years, as long as I can remember, when big historic events have occurred, and national commissions have been created, and they've been very, very important. I go all the way back when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. 7 days later, there was a national commission headed by the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, appointed by President Johnson, and it was the Warren Commission. And what it established once and for all was President Kennedy was assassinated by Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald worked alone, and Jack Ruby also shot Oswald as a loner. Before that, there have been all sorts of conspiracy theories, like what we're seeing now about January 6th. Missions clear the air. They allow everybody to sort of close the chapter and move on to the next event. But right now, in the midst of this calamity that we're still going through, it's really unbelievable that the Republican Party, which has been led the way on having a commission after 9/11, led the way on having a commission under George W. Bush on terror, on voting rights, that the GOP helped greatly. Gerald Ford was on that Warren Commission. Been involved. The GOP now draw the line that no, we don't have anything to do with this. Only tells us, raises the question, what are they hiding?
Yeah, I mean, Congressman, it seems to me this is no longer a bug. It is the feature of a big part of the Republican Party. What do you think?
Well, I don't know why anybody who's an elected official would be swapping air molecules with a conspiracy grunt on the border. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me as somebody who has, taken the oath to defend this Constitution, not only in the military, but also as a congressman. It's appalling. But you're seeing it everywhere, right, John? You have a Q influencer that got media credentials for Trump's rally in Florida, right? You have Trump putting out these missives that are more and more ridiculous. So I think right now it's baked in. I think you're right, John. When you said that this is, more of a feature, right? It's the fact is that this has become this sort of apocalyptic good against evil conspiracy that's going on. But to actually pal around with somebody with a criminal record, somebody who was there, somebody who bragged about being there, and to take selfies with these, congressional representatives, I think it goes to show right now that we need a fix, and we need to find out how this disinformation spreads. We need a committee or a commission. We need this to happen. And I would hope that I can be involved somehow, as you know, John, with my background in intel. But right now it just seems like they want to swap spit with these guys, and I think that's something that's really going to hurt the GOP in the long term.
I mean, isn't it possible that they're there with this guy because they want to be there with this guy? If not literally, then at least figuratively, that they want to be seen as at least being open to this kind of thing. I mean, why else would you have a guy like Andrew Clyde and others calling this a normal tourist visit?
Well, I know exactly, right? Maybe they thought it was just a tourist there to take selfies with them, right, John? I mean, and by the way, some of them are saying, oh, we don't know who it was and things like that, but where's security? I mean, is this guy vetted in there? So remember, I was a congressman. It's hard to BS me. So how did this guy get in there? Was he invited, by somebody down there to come along on this trip as an interpreter or whatnot? That's what should scare people, is that we have idiots like this that are palling around with congressional representatives that either they're being deliberately obtuse, right? Or they're not smart enough to figure it out. And both of those, right, are probably disqualifying to be in Congress. But right now, it is looking at polling and stuff like that, John, I think it's actually getting more powerful out there, this type of belief system.
So, David, we see new videos released almost every day, or at least every week, of what happened in the insurrection. It's horrifying. I mean, it's just horrifying what happened that day. It was horrifying on that day. In a way, we shouldn't need more videos to make reasonable people more horrified, but I'm wondering if you think they make any difference anymore.
it doesn't make it much difference as it used to, John, but I do think that over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to have two big elections when American people are going to be asked to judge, you know, what happened on January 6th, the off-year elections, and then the presidential elections in 2024. These will be central, but it's really important that we be able to have a discourse that's about truth and about facts as opposed to conspiracies. And that's why a commission is bipartisan. And give credit to Liz Cheney that being willing to, when invited, she said, yes, I'll do this. And really aggravated, as you can imagine, Kevin McCarthy, no end. He's going to apparently strip her of other responsibilities in Congress and threatening others who may sign up. What we need is a commission. Kevin McCarthy got to get on board and support it.
Well, look, the bipartisan commission isn't happening. Yep. The independent bipartisan commission is not happening at this point. We have this select committee, Congressman. You've got experience working with these people. They were your colleagues just a few months ago. What is it that you think, or how is it that you think Kevin McCarthy ultimately will approach this? Is this something he'll try somehow to muck up?
Yeah, he's got to scoff it. I mean, if they're looking at the if they're looking at the polls, if they're looking at the fundraising for each of the individual members in these districts, he's going to have to push it to the side, and he's going to have to make fun of it. He's going to have to make it partisan. He's going to have to push it to as far as the left, saying this is ridiculous. You know, it's problematic. It's provocative. You know, you got to use these hyperbolic words to get people riled up and to sort of dismiss it. And I think that's a huge mistake. This is an American problem. It's not a Republican or Democratic problem. It is time for us, for Americans, to do something to find out in analysis what happened on January 6th, how it happened. And we need to go back a year or two. We need to actually get everybody in the same room, domestic individuals, transnational threats. We need to engage, you know, the some of the stuff that we have going on, like with the Global Engagement Center, looking how transnational and domestic threats actually fuse. And we need to look at the gaps and the priorities that we need to actually look at that law enforcement didn't have time to do to see why this happened. This is absolutely friggin' necessary. And I'm still can't get my arms around the fact that we have individuals pushing back on that after what happened to individuals, after the Americans that were affected, after individuals like Michael Fanone getting almost beat to death. Enough of this crap. And I think at this point, you know, I'm frustrated based on my background in intel, because I know we can figure this out.
Again, I don't think the crap is a bug. I think at this point we have to assume it's a feature. And, you know, fasten your seatbelts, because watching how they try to approach this committee will be fascinating. David Gergen, I appreciate you being with us. Congressman Ringelmann, thanks to you. Have a wonderful holiday weekend, both of you.
Thanks,
you too, buddy.
Next, new insight into how the former president is taking yesterday's indictment of his company and his finance chief, and later a string of breaking news in the Surfside tragedy, including word that residents of another building in the area have been told it's no longer safe to live in. Irony is dead tonight. Donald Trump Jr. killed it. Reacting to the tax-related criminal charges against the family company and the chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, young Master Trump told Fox News, quote, "This is what Vladimir Putin does." As for how his father has been taking the news, CNN political analyst and New York Times Washington correspondent Maggie Haberman joins us now with her new reporting. Also, CNN senior legal analyst and former federal prosecutor Ellie Honig. Maggie, first to you. Look, you know, Trump world trying to send off signals. Oh, this is no big deal, the indictments. Oh, it's just a partisan witch hunt. Oh, nothing to see here. What's really going on behind the scenes? What is the real feeling among the president and his close advisors?
Look, John, you're going to continue to see the former president describe this as a witch hunt and describe this as a partisan investigation. Part of that is going to be because of Cy Vance. Part of that is going to be because of the Attorney General, Letitia James in New York, who is also working on this case with Vance. But in reality, Donald Trump is not somebody who has sought to be indicted. He is not somebody who thought this was a good thing. There was some spin from one of his advisors earlier this week about how, or right before the indictment, about how he was, quote unquote, thrilled. He's not thrilled. You know, I don't think he's throwing staplers, but he's not happy. It's not something that he's talking about constantly as, you know, as fury. But this is not where they want to be. This is a totally new world for him, John. And I think that what you've seen with the former president and his advisors and members of his family and his allies is they have conflated legal problems with public relations problems for so long that I think some of them are losing sight of the fact this is actually an indictment. Now, it's not an indictment of Donald Trump personally, but it is an indictment of his CFO and of his company. And these are even if they want to dispute the case and whether it's fair and whether it would be brought against somebody else, the reality is that Alan Weisselberg, the CFO, is facing potential jail time, and that can change things. It may not. He has indicated he's not going to cooperate with prosecutors, but we'll see where this goes.
Was the indictment, Maggie, part of the former president's regular TV viewing yesterday?
The former president was definitely watching the news coverage. And one of the things that I think people don't understand about how he watches television is it isn't just glued to the box. He often has it on in the background and then looks up and looks at things. But the TV is often on, and he was well aware of the coverage yesterday.
So, Ellie, from a legal perspective, what happens now? The arraignment is come and gone. What's the goal among the New York prosecutors? Still to get Weisselberg to flip?
I think so, absolutely, John. Look, there's one of two things that yesterday's indictment is. Scenario one is this could be prosecutors shooting their shot, putting their best foot forward and hoping they get something out of this. If that's the case, it's really not much. I think what the scenario is, having been a prosecutor for a long time, is they are trying to strategically target, leverage, and pressure Alan Weisselberg to flip. Whenever you're trying to break into a closed society, a closed organization like the Trump Organization, this is what prosecutors do. You look at the org chart, you say, who might be vulnerable, who actually might flip, and who can deliver the goods? And if you look at that, for the Trump org, everyone in that inner circle, except for Alan Weisselberg, has the last name Trump. They're not going to flip. So I think the prosecutors are putting an awful lot of eggs in the basket of flipping Weisselberg. But as Maggie said, the status quo at the moment is he's not interested. Now, I've seen people who I never expected to flip have a change of heart when they see that indictment and feel those handcuffs. So that, to me, is the biggest thing to watch in this case moving forward.
Ellie, I learned today that you literally taught a class on flipping witnesses when you were in the prosecutor's office. So what's going on behind the scenes? I mean, what are they saying to Weisselberg and his team? How quickly does this happen?
Well, I think they said something loud and clear with the indictment yesterday. When I looked at that indictment, I will tell you the evidence against Alan Weisselberg was significantly stronger than I suspected. John, you coined the phrase the smoking spreadsheet, which I think is a very clear piece of evidence. Another piece of evidence that jumped off the page to me is they have evidence that Alan Weisselberg tampered with a record. They allege in the indictment that Weisselberg told another unnamed person at the Trump org, take my name off that document. There was a notation that said per Alan Weisselberg. Weisselberg said, get my name off there. That is really incriminating evidence. So if Alan Weisselberg's sitting there with his attorneys today, I think his attorneys have to tell him, look, they have a strong case against you. You're about to turn 74 years old, Alan. And if you get convicted here, you could go away for several years. So you need to let that sit for a bit as a prosecutor. But that indictment sent a message yesterday.
You know, Maggie, I think people forget sometimes that the Trump Organization is a family business, a relatively small in some ways family business, right. A family business now under indictment. And you're one of the reporters, you have a byline on a story, which I think is really interesting in the Times, which talks about how this indictment could affect the family business almost immediately. What will the impact be?
So, John, the biggest question right now is what this means in terms of the Trump Organization's relationship with its lenders in various areas, whether that is lenders on specific properties, whether that is lenders that you know we're not aware of, frankly. But oftentimes there are covenants that are agreed to between lenders and a company or an organization as to a specific project or as to an amount of capital that is being given to the company. Some of those covenants suggest that there could be, and I'm not saying that's the case here, I'm saying this is just what happens, is that there can be situations created in these covenants where the lenders would have the ability, banks, for instance, would have the ability to walk away. Now, Donald Trump has had a very charmed life in terms of this. He has generally, even when people thought banks would walk away from him, even when banks themselves suffered, he has still always managed to find a way, so we will see. But that would be the biggest way in which you could see some impact.
Ellie Honig, let's role play here. Ellie Honig for the defense. If you're Alan Weisselberg's lawyer, what are you telling him today?
The first thing I'm telling him is they've got a good case against you. You really ought to think about cooperating. I mean, look, any person who's been charged with an indictment has three options. Number one, you can cooperate. If you do that, given the nature of the charges here, you have a very good chance to get probation, to not go to jail. Option two is you can just plead guilty without cooperating, without helping them out. If you do that, Mr. Weisselberg, you have a chance to get maybe a year or two. If you look at the New York guidelines, 2 or 3 years. but maybe I, your defense lawyer, can argue to the judge for probation. We'd be rolling the dice. Option three is you can go to trial. I think anyone who advises a client has to tell them that most defendants, varies a bit by jurisdiction, get convicted at trial. And if you get convicted at trial, you very likely will get sentenced to several years in prison. So those are the three options that Alan Weisselberg's sitting with. And one other thing that's important, building off what Maggie just said, the money matters a lot. The two scenarios where I've seen people cooperate the most are one, of course, to avoid or minimize jail time. But two, when that money runs out, when the money to fight the cases, when the money to pay the lawyers, when the money to maintain the rich lifestyles runs out, that's when people flip as well. So that's a factor that's playing into all of this.
Maggie, very quickly, because we got to run here, but what is the former president more focused on at this point, politics or business?
I don't know how you separate them, John. I mean, I think that the politics gives him some sense of a shield to say that this is a political witch hunt. I mean, I think he would say it anyway. And the politics allow him to keep raising money. The second that he says that he's not running for president again, he is not able to raise money anymore. So I think they are intertwined. And frankly, John, that has often been a problem for him, is that they're always intertwined, the politics and the business. That's not the issue with this case, to be very, very clear. But that has been a question that has dogged him since he first ran for office.
I knew you were going to go for option C there. I just knew it. All right, Maggie Haberman, Ellie Honig, our thanks to both of you. Have a great weekend. Happy birthday, America, as we like to say.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Maggie.
Next, fears about the safety of residents in another condo tonight, just a short drive from the condo that collapsed last week. Also, we have the story of a reunion, survivors from that deadly collapse. One, an 88-year-old grandmother who couldn't walk on her own. The other, a man who made sure that she made it to safety. Breaking news involving the condo collapse in Surfside, Florida, that we learned today has now officially claimed at least 22 lives. Concerns about the stability of the remaining portion of the building. We'll have more on that in just a moment. But first, another condominium just a short drive away, now the focus of safety concerns, with authorities taking extraordinary measures there tonight. Rosa Flores joins us from North Miami Beach, Florida, with the very latest. Rosa, tell me about this building and exactly what the concern is and how they're responding.
You know, it is shocking to the people that I've been talking to who live in this building. They say that they were given 2 to 3 hours that a police officer was standing outside their door telling them that they had to grab what they could and go, that they needed to exit the building. John, here's the backstory. According to officials, after Surfside, the story that we've been covering for more than a week now, officials asked all of the buildings to submit their paperwork to make sure that these buildings were safe. Well, the building that you see behind me submitted this report just today. It's dated January 1st. Today is July 2nd. This report on the very first page, John, says it is structurally not safe. It is electrically not safe. That's exactly why city officials say that they immediately took action given what happened in Surfside and asked all of these residents to get out. From talking to some of these residents, they're emotional, and of course they're counting their blessings because they know what happened in Surfside, but they're also angry because this is from at least 6 months ago. And so their concern is, why were they not told about this earlier? From what I hear from city officials, they are asking the Red Cross to help out because, of course, now all of these people are homeless. Now, this building was built in 1972. It has more than 150 units. They don't have an exact manifest as of now. They're trying to figure that out, and they're trying to help all of these people who are now homeless. John, they're trying to figure out exactly where to go. And John, you and I were talking about the 40-year certification of the building that collapsed in Surfside. Well, the certification for this building was never turned in. Yeah. That is one of the big concerns. And of course, this is all after the Surfside collapse. That's the reason why these documents are now being turned in and city officials are taking action.
And they're taking it seriously now. Rosa, very quickly, what did the Miami-Dade mayor announce today in terms of the remaining structure from the Champlain Tower South?
Well, the mayor says that she signed a demolition order, and this is the first step to demolish that remaining portion of that building. Of course, we all know, and she emphasized, it is a public health issue. It is a public safety issue. And they know that that portion of the building has to be demolished. Now, she says it's not going to happen before the hurricane that is that has formed in the Gulf. She says it probably will take a few weeks. It's the structural engineers who will make the decisions, who will figure out exactly how and when this will happen, John. But you and I know that this is a very emotional moment for the families, because we know that there are still people under that rubble.
Rosa Flores, thank you so much for this reporting. A lot going on there, to say the least. And we have two stories we want to tell you about that speak to the emotional toll this has taken on everyone involved, from those who were in the building as well as those involved in the search and rescue effort. Randy Kaye joins us now from Surfside. And Randy, you're learning more about one of the victims. What can you tell us?
Well, John, another child has been pulled from the rubble, this time a 7-year-old girl. She was recovered by Miami Fire Search and Rescue. And it turns out that she is the daughter of a firefighter who works with Miami Fire Search and Rescue. He was actually working on the pile at the time. He did not find his daughter, but a search team from Task Force 2 did, and they called him over and told him that tragic news. So you can just imagine, John, how difficult it is for this family. This little girl has not been identified publicly, nor as her father. The family is asking for privacy at this time, but certainly a very, very difficult situation for them, like it is for so many families here in the Surfside area. Also tonight, John, we are learning more about those who ran for safety as that building came crumbling down around them. And we're hearing stories of neighbors jumping into action to save neighbors. We met two of them today.
All of a sudden, I hear a boom, and my bed shake, and I see my apartment is shaking.
When Champlain Towers South shook in the middle of the night, Esther Gorfinkel was in bed on the fifth floor. The 88-year-old grandmother quickly made her way from Unit 509 to the stairwell. Soon, Alfredo Lopez spotted her. He and his family had escaped apartment 605.
I remember Esther told me that she had, her knee was bothering her and that she wanted to stop. You know, I told her, you know, stopping is not an option, you know.
There was no way you were going to let her stay.
No, I just, you know, like, it just didn't even occur to me, you know. Like, I mean, I can't, you know, she's a human being.
But Esther couldn't walk on her own, so Alfredo picked her up, tossed her over his shoulder, and carried her down.
I don't know how many flights of stairs. It couldn't have been that many because I'm really not that strong.
He just picked me up.
Esther and Alfredo hadn't seen each other since that terrible night when he saved her life, until we brought them together.
How are you?
¿Cómo estás?
I'm so happy.
I'm so happy too. I'm so happy to see you. And you know, we made it out, you know, so that's what's important, right?
Yes, yes, that's important.
Okay, good.
I'm so happy, you know, up there,
yes.
Somebody's watching.
Absolutely. It wasn't, you know, simply, you know, Esther, it just wasn't our time, you know.
Together, they recounted their chance meeting in the stairwell and their narrow escape.
In that minute, you don't talk. You don't say anything. Let's run. Let's go.
They made it to the garage, but they still weren't out of danger. The garage ceiling had collapsed and water was ankle deep.
There was one car that was pancaked on top of another car that was pancaked on top of a huge slab of concrete.
A mountain of debris proved too much for Esther, so Alfredo had to think fast. His son helped too.
You know, somebody push me.
Yeah, you know, we gave her like the old, you know, 1-2, like, you know, let's, you know, just pushing her, you know.
Push her over the...
Well, we pushed her up. And we got out of the garage, which was very important.
After they cleared the garage, Alfredo put Esther over his shoulder once again and carried her to safety on the beach.
What do you think about somebody who would do that?
They think in somebody else when they see something bad. You know, you need to help each other in bad times too. It's not other choice. Remember, everybody having his bad time. What I can tell you.
It's just so beautiful that they helped you.
You know, in bad times, you help everybody. Whoever knocks in my door and need help, I give it to them. And then God give me the price of my life because I did so many good things.
How lucky do you feel today?
I know I'm lucky. Very lucky to be here with my family. Thanks God. Thanks God.
That night, Alfredo and Esther lost everything they owned, but they escaped with their lives and a friendship that is sure to endure.
You made me very happy.
And this really was a team effort to get Esther safely out of that building. Another man did help. His name is Albert Aguero. And Esther, of course, wants to thank him for helping as well. He actually pulled as Alfredo pushed to get her out of that garage area. And Esther believes that her parents and her husband were also, they also had a hand in this, that they gave these men the strength to save her. And I did talk to Alfredo, and he was telling me today that he does have some survivor's guilt, John. He doesn't understand why he and Esther and others survived, and it seems as though so many others did not. He was very emotional talking about when he first opened his apartment door to flee, and he looked at his neighbor's door right next door to him, and it was just a big, black, gaping hole, and there has been no sign of her since. That's haunting him to this day and still very hard for him to deal with, John.
Randy, that story was beautiful. Just beautiful. In bad times, you have to help people. So important. Thank you so much
Absolutely.
For that, Randy. Just ahead, the closing of Bagram Air Base and the ending of our nearly two-decade war in Afghanistan. We're going to have a live report from Kabul on what comes next. And later, should using pot keep athletes out of the Olympics? We're going to discuss the plight of Sha'Carri Richardson with a three-time Olympic gold medalist when we continue. President Biden grew visibly frustrated today with questions from reporters about the future of Afghanistan, preparing to keep the focus on the economy on the 4th of July, even as a major chapter in the U.S. war there comes to a close. The last American troops have now left Bagram Air Base, a major symbol of the American military presence in Afghanistan for nearly two decades. Anna Corrin has more on what the exit means for the mission that's ending, as well as the one now beginning for the Afghans.
The vast might of the U.S. military transformed this dusty airstrip into a miniature city and the nucleus of America's longest war. Ultimately, that might could not transform Afghanistan. Friday morning, nearly 20 years after U.S. soldiers captured Bagram Air Base as a launch pad for the war on terror, the last U.S. servicemen and women departed Afghanistan. A nation not left strong, prosperous, or secure, despite the sacrifice of more than 2,400 American lives and over 100,000 Afghan civilians, according to the United Nations.
Deserted street in a faraway country.
Many of those fallen soldiers repatriated from these runways, now in the possession of Afghan government forces as they continue their lonely fight with the Taliban. They are the only ones who will consider Friday's U.S. departure a victory.
The security situation is not good right now. That's something that's recognized by the Afghan security forces, and they're making the appropriate adjustments as we move forward.
Taliban fighters have seized back swathes of the country Americans fought and died to liberate. After once boasting a force of over 100,000 in Afghanistan, there will remain as few as 600 U.S. troops here to provide security for American diplomats.
We intend to maintain a diplomatic presence in Kabul. That is something that is important to us, given our enduring desire to have a continued partnership with the Afghan government and, crucially, with the Afghan people.
I'm speaking to you today.
Their forever war will continue as Joe Biden wades out of the mire, a mire that trapped his predecessors in a brutal and bloody stalemate. Bush, Obama, and Trump, each bouncing in and out of Bagram, pledging Afghanistan will never be a haven for terrorists, as it was when Al-Qaeda plotted the tragedy of 9/11. Those terrorists long since rooted out and destroyed. Now, no guarantee that violent extremists won't re-enter the vacuum left by the United States as the last American soldiers out of Afghanistan return to a nation that has long waited to welcome them home.
Anna Corrin joins us now live from Kabul. Anna, so much concern for the Afghan support personnel who worked alongside the American military there. What is the latest on how, if, and when the U.S. will help these people?
Well, obviously, John, the safety and security of those Afghan translators, interpreters and other workers who worked alongside U.S. troops and diplomats throughout this 20-year war is paramount. Their lives are at risk due to the deteriorating security situation. We've seen the Taliban launch this offensive across the country, particularly in the north, gaining momentum and gaining territory. And it's because of that, and also the fact that the U.S. troop have brought their withdrawal forward by 2 months, that has exacerbated that threat. We know that there are 18,000 Afghans who've applied for this special immigrant visa, and it's hoped by the Biden administration that they can fast-track the process by putting these Afghans into a third country, keeping them safe, whilst they can process these visas to the United States. The Biden administration is in talks with countries here in Central Asia, neighbours with Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and they're hoping that they can strike some sort of deal to get these Afghans to safety before moving them on to the United States. President Biden, John, vowing that every Afghan who risks his life, his or her life for America will not be left behind, John.
Has to be done quickly. Anna Korn in Kabul, thank you so much for that. The Olympic dreams of U.S. track star Sha'Carri Richardson are now on hold after she tested positive for THC, the chemical in marijuana. What she is saying about it all, and the question some are asking tonight, is the punishment too strict? I'll talk it over with former Olympic sprinter champion Gail Devers. An Olympic surprise. U.S. sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson will not be allowed to run the 100-meter race later this month at the Summer Games. The 21-year-old tested positive for THC, the chemical in marijuana, invalidating her win at the U.S. trials last month. She had been considered a favorite in Tokyo. Richardson says she used marijuana in Oregon, where it's legal, by the way, after learning that her biological mother had died. She says she was trying to hide her pain after the news was broken to her by a reporter. This is what she said about it this morning.
I apologize for the fact that I didn't know how to control my emotions or deal with my emotions during that time. But sitting here, I just say, don't judge me because I am human. I'm you. I just happen to run a little faster.
Many hoped with Richardson in Tokyo, the U.S. might win its first Olympic gold medal in the 100-meter women's race since Gail Devers did in 1996. And joining us now is Gail Devers, an honor to speak with you. Listen, when you first heard the news that Sha'Carri Richardson will not be able to run the 100-meter race in Tokyo, I wonder what went through your mind.
I kind of just said, wow, you know, and then when I found out, you know, what it was, that it was marijuana, it's an unfortunate situation because, you know, she was on a great path to bring home the gold. And, you know, it's one of those things that happen. I love the fact that she has always said that she wanted to be transparent. And so she took responsibility and she's taking the ban. So
yeah, she owned this. I mean, she absolutely did take responsibility, says she accepts the punishment. I mean, no one disputes that there is a rule and that she broke the rule. The question, Gail, is should there be a rule at this point for marijuana when marijuana is legal in Oregon? You know, where she used it, alcohol is not illegal. Is it a fair rule to begin with?
Well, you know what? I always tell people that we choose to run track and field. That's our sport. And in our sport, there's a governing body that governs our sports, and there's rules and regulations that we may not agree with, but until we change them, we have to abide by them. And you heard Sha'Carri say that, you know, she's not telling someone to do it or not to do it. This was a choice that she made to cope with the things that she had to cope with. And that's why she's accepting that ban. It's 30 days. She'll be back. If you watched her, like, she's unapologetically Sha'Carri. And what she does is she doesn't run with question marks. When she's done with the race, she's put it all on the line. And that's what people were loving about her and will continue to do that in 30 days.
And there is a chance she'll be able to run the 4x100 relay. We don't know yet. But, you know, what must her feelings be? How would you feel if someone told you a month before the games that you couldn't compete in your best race?
Well, let's think about the challenges that we've all had to face with this pandemic, and not knowing as an athlete, these athletes not knowing if the games were going to go off or not go off. What were they doing? What gets you there keeps you there. So what they were doing was the same thing. They were still training. They may have had to find a different venue. It may be in the garage. It may be in a park. So knowing Sha'Carri, as far as what we've seen of her, she is that determined person that she's going to be ready. What distinguishes people is access and opportunity. So when they say whatever they to her, if they say, yes, you can go run here, or you have to wait till after the games, I believe she's going to be ready to get out there. You know, one of the things that watching, I become a fan of my sport, and watching her, one of the things that I loved about her was that she's patient. Whether she gets out the blocks or not, she's patient in her run. And she's one of the most technically sound athletes that we've seen in a very long time. And I think these are the things that, you know, when you're faced with a challenge, you have to find that inner strength. And I like that she said she's going to take this time to deal with herself and to heal. And, you know, that brings about that mental health thing that we're all dealing with and trying to figure out, how do we rally around these athletes? You know, with stardom and fame comes a big responsibility in addition to your personal things that you have to deal with, which we're seeing this. We got a taste of that after she won and told us about, you know, the death of her mother and how she coped with it.
Gail Devers, I have to say, I'm sure she'd be thrilled to have you rallying behind her right now. An honor to speak with you. Thank you so much. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Up next, in the heartache of Surfside, a place to remember. There's a solemn place near the condo collapse in Surfside where photos of victims and those unaccounted for have been left by family and friends. And one high school student is doing something extra special. Look at all those flowers. Steve Ferrero runs a nonprofit called Helping Others and Giving Hope. Now he's teamed up with florists, so there's always fresh flowers on the site.
I've cried a couple times, you know. Even the firefighters that are out there, I mean, it's not easy. It's very emotional. I mean, for everyone, it's, you know, it's very hard to keep it a straight face. But, you know, for those families, you have to. You know, you have to make sure you're giving them hope.
Yes, it is all about hope. And our hearts go out to all those in Surfside tonight. That is all for us. The news continues. Time for primetime and good man Michael Smirkanish. Michael.
Quality sleep is essential. And that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.